The nation of Guyana sits at the center of one of the fastest energy expansions in the world, but rapid growth brings difficult questions. What are the risks, trade-offs, and strategy behind turning a historic resource boom into lasting national development? Welcome to Baker Briefing, where we make news make sense. I'm Ken Medlock, director of the Baker Institute Center for Energy Studies. Since oil production began in 2019, Guyana has rapidly emerged as a major force in global energy markets. The president of Guyana, His Excellency Irfan Ali, visited Rice University on May 4, 2026, to share his perspective on the country's rise as a global energy player. In our previous episode, we explored President Ali's vision for how Guyana is using its energy boom to drive diversification, strengthen human capital, and position itself in a rapidly changing global order. In part two, President Ali sits down with Baker Institute fellow Francisco Minaldi for a candid armchair conversation on what comes next for Guyana. They move from big picture vision to the practical realities of execution, how to manage hydrocarbon expansion, attract investment, and build the infrastructure needed to sustain rapid growth. This episode was recorded in front of a live audience and has been edited for clarity. Let's get to it.
Thank you, Mr. President. As Ambassador Satterfield mentioned, we have been looking at the impressive developments in your country. We have been talking to your government, talking to the business community in Guyana, and also establishing cooperation with the University of Guyana. I want to talk a little bit about some of the topics you mentioned. One is, of course, what are the plans in terms of the hydrocarbon sector itself? You recently did a round of allocation of some blocks, and you got Total and Qatar Energy and Petronas and Civil Energy. And of course, you also are bringing natural gas to onshore for electricity, for power production. How do you envision, other than the development of potential that you already have discovered, how do you envision the hydrocarbon sector developing in the future?
I deliberately did not speak on the development of hydrocarbon because I think that development is speaking for itself globally. Every serious investor, every serious player in the hydrocarbon industry knows where Guyana is located now. They know what is happening. They know the reserve. They know the potential. They know those who are investing. And they know our strategy in relation to gas, a strategy that looks to unlock the gas potential, to reduce the cost of electricity, expand opportunity for manufacturing industrial development, integrate our grid with that of Northern Brazil, Suriname, and to be a net energy supplier to the rest of the region. So we have to also be conscious that we have policy environment over the last 2 years, 3 years, that has been very supportive to oil and gas development and investment. And that can change. We have seen prior to that a policy environment that disincentivized investment in oil and gas. And we have seen the effects of that. We felt the effects of that. We had energy, a port project. That was vetoed when it went to IDB Invest, to the board, because it was believed that the investment was linked to energy. So we understand the moment in time. And this is the moment, I think, that you have to capitalize on the finances. And there is greater appetite for financing energy projects, financing hydrocarbon opportunities, especially those like you have in Guyana. So our strategy has been very clear. You know, many people also ask about the agreement with Exxon. And we have made it very clear that the sanctity of contract is important for us. But we also said that it will be a new production sharing agreement. And that agreement has been finalized, and that's a new agreement that governs new development. So there's no second guessing what we are doing. We are ready to make the hard decisions. We make those decisions. We make them public. We stand by the decisions we make. So there's predictability. One of the most important things in this sector is predictability. If investors cannot see predictability in your policymaking, in your decision-making, and the way you're approaching this sector, then you will find it very difficult. And that brings me to the question of our neighbors that I'm sure you will want to ask. And is it a question of predictability? Would this solution work? Would the existing structure work? What would it lead to? How predictable it is for it to lead to the outcomes that you want, whether it's democratic elections? And those are the questions investors must ask and answer for themselves. And when you look at Guyana, they see a country that is rule-based, a country that is democratic, a country that is, as policies are predictable, is clearly defined, clearly written. There is a production sharing agreement that is applicable across the board. So the development of the hydrocarbon industry is based on results. Guyana has shown that we have the results. It's based on potential. We have shown that there is immeasurable potential in Guyana. It is based on the practicality and predictability of the system. We have shown that. It is based on the robustness of the system. We have shown that. And it is based on the understanding that this is a country that sees hydrocarbon development as something not for the next 10 years or 20 years, but as a critical component of that energy balance very, 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 very long into the future. And if you look at the data and you look at the stats, then there is no other conclusion than the fact that any suggestion that the oil and gas sector is approaching its deathbed is such imaginary. The data does not support that. The facts does not support that. The predictions does not support that. And the development of the world does not support that. That is why we believe that the hydrocarbon sector has a long future in Guyana, and we are maximizing the opportunity and potential, knowing fully well, though, that at this moment, there is greater potential for financing and investment.
Thank you. Of course, the recent events in the Middle East and also in Russia have focused South America and particularly Guyana for the reasons that you mentioned in terms of stability, democracy, etc., as a prime destination for potential investments. And it also at the same time is bringing a windfall of resources for your country. Of course, it depends how long high prices remain. But I wonder, how do you manage the expectations of the population? Because of course, these things take time and sometimes people might get impatient. You know, I've seen in other countries around the world that that match between expectations and you know, possibilities sometimes creates. Of course, you were reelected with a very significant margin recently, but have you managed in the past the expectation? How do you will manage them in the future? And also how you combine sort of the prudence with the macroeconomic stability. You have a natural resource fund. As you pointed out, you are focusing on long-term infrastructure investment to increase productivity, which will allow the sort of issues of the Dutch disease to be tamed by having a more efficient country, a more productive country. How do you manage to balance these different dimensions?
I want to start from the premise of your question, and that is the windfall because of what is happening. And we have to be careful about classifying this as a windfall because we live in a global system. We don't live on an island by ourselves. Whilst we see increase in revenue from crude oil, we also see massive increase in everything else. Global transportation, fertilizer, grains, insurance, every single aspect, food prices, pharmaceuticals, because some of the important ingredients for pharmaceuticals, you will see the impact on the speed of AI and digitization when we see the impact on the production of semiconductors. So this crisis is multifaceted. And yes, you will get some additional revenue, but you would have to net off that against the increased costs, increase prices, and the opportunity is missed because investments would also be redirected to rebuilding. And we are not calculating that in the matrix as yet. How much investments will go back to rebuilding? Where those investments will be made mostly? Whether countries will now try to shore up your military capacity and capability? Whether countries will try to build new systems to avoid drones? What are the new critical infrastructure routes that will be created? Whether it's maritime routes? Who are the new strategic partners that will be integrated together? These are all big questions that this conflict has opened up, that we will have to maneuver. So yes, additional revenue, windfall, I will not go so far because you have to balance this off. Now that this brings me to the question of additional revenue. And we have Exxon in the room here too. This allows us to deal with the cost bank at a faster pace. So we also have to match that with the expectations of Exxon in moving to a new development, how we add new costs to the bank, but how we deal with the cost bank so that we can now get the additional revenue to come into the system to help the development and deal with the expectations. And this is the complexity of the messaging. When people wake up every morning and see the headlines that you're flush with money, it drives a certain expectation. That expectation, if not managed, and if governed by knee-jerk reaction, can lead to the resource curse. It can also lead to creating a society that is not built on sacrifice and hard work, that is not built on the value of labor, the value of innovation, the value of ideas, the value of creativity. And we have to avoid that. That is why we're investing in tools and mechanisms that will optimize the potential of our people, give them a high quality of life, and open up opportunities for them. That is why the local content legislation is so important in developing as much local opportunities from the sector as possible. One of the differences here is that our development is deep water. So while it may have thousands of persons on a FPSO, a deep sea, the population will hardly see that. They don't fill hotels, hotel rooms or apartments. And that's a big difference. Therefore, we have to create the type of infrastructure and model that will allow the other aspect of the economy to showcase how the revenue unlock opportunities for our people. Take, for example, hotels. In the last 4 or 5 years, we have 14 hotels, international branded hotels, completed or under construction, nearing completion. We have to ensure that those hotels are meaningful. That is why we have to build out an orange economy that creates demand. So this is where the revenue and the model becomes critical. Increasing pensions, whether it's old age pension, free education, university education, all of it free. Free healthcare, investing in a world-class healthcare system, world-class infrastructure that allows your value and your property to go up. We have property values that went up by thousands of percentage points. That increases your net value, unlock financial capital liquidity for you to start a new business. So these are all spin-off effects of the strategic investments that we are making to create an enabling environment for prosperity and wealth creation. But managing that expectation is not easy, especially in a world where, as some people classify it, we are in an information pandemic. If you look at social media, the speed at which information flows, every time the Minister of Finance, by law, must declare all the revenue that comes into the natural resource fund within 30 days. Every time that declaration is made, it's a national headline. But expectation that comes out of those headlines makes it sometimes very difficult for the policy-making environment. Because whilst you make long-term decision. You have to always understand that the short-term interest and expectation must be examined. And we are in the business of policymaking, but we are also politicians who are elected. And it will be foolish not to address these challenges. But it is a responsibility of addressing it, keeping in mind the long-term sustainability of the country. That is why we prefer to invest in opportunities that create wealth, invest in the development of the human capital and infrastructure, social safety nets that allow our people not to lose their own capacity to be innovative, hard workers, and to be builders rather than waiters. Waiters for opportunity. Waiter for a cash grant. Waiter for some cash transfer. We don't know, ultimately, where the price of oil and gas will rest. What we know, it will not be where it is today. We also know that Guyana is blessed because of the cost of recovery. Our break-even point is much more efficient than many other producers, which allow us to be in the top tier of development and developers. That's an added advantage that will work in our favor in an oil-producing world beyond 2060, because then efficiency of production comes into play, and efficiency of production with least impact on the environment becomes a major indicator of success and who will be able to stay in the industry. And that is what positions Guyana ahead of all its competitors. And that is what positions our investors in the best possible market in the long term. And I'm sure they know this.
The one thing that is amazing is the low carbon intensity per barrel of Guyana's oil, right? It will allow you to be among the producers that, you know, as carbon pricing or any other measure in this area advances, you will have an additional competitive advantage, not only the cost advantage, but also the low carbon intensity is a really good. We have to take you to another meeting right away, but one last question. We have in the U.S., in other parts of the world, a large Guyanese diaspora. And of course, one of the challenges of any country that is growing so fast as your country is the issue of migration, people wanting to move to Guyana too. And of course, the locals want to be sort of first to benefit. And we have different models around the world. You know, in the Gulf countries, we saw a massive movement of expats. But you, different from other countries, have that sort of potential advantage that you have a significant diaspora that you can tap in terms of capital, knowledge, know-how, and perhaps even some of them moving there. How do you see that? And do you have a sort of a message for the diaspora here in the U.S.?
We have been talking to the diaspora a lot. But let me say a few things on that. And I like to be very practical. We have an open system where everyone can benefit from the opportunities that exist in Guyana. Our diaspora is indeed huge. We have a major labor problem in Guyana right now. Don't have enough workers to fuel the opportunities and potential. But our diaspora is also in a special and unique position within the U.S. Let's take the U.S. for example. Many of them are in that period of their career in which they're finishing off their career to ensure that their pensions are secured. Then you have another set that has advanced and built a career on which they're now working to be the top of where they are. And then you have those who were born over here who will have to make complete new transition. So they have to balance that decision. What I've seen from the diaspora is that, one, we have a lot of them coming back, a lot of them wanting to come back, but a lot of them wanting to be in the position of enjoying the opportunities that exist in both worlds. Nothing is wrong with that. So more and more, I'm seeing the greater opportunity in how they can invest back in Guyana and get a decent return. I see more of them wanting to be part of the growth story, because we are not at a stage where we can say we'll pay a specialist doctor $25,000 every month. Whilst the salaries have increased dramatically, you can't compare us now to Qatar or UAE that may pay the upper skill level that salary, because we are still going through our cost band. And we are not at that stage, but we have increased the salary and increased the earning power enormously by hundreds of percentages, thousands in some cases. So you have to look, the younger members of the diaspora also have to look at this as a sacrifice that would eventually give them better returns than they have now. So if you are a young doctor with 5 years and come back in the system, your propensity to save might be almost the same. But from a dollar-to-dollar perspective, there might be some difference. But your opportunity to advance in Guyana and the pace at which your income will develop and advance will be far different from what can happen here in the next 10 years. So it is that honest conversation that is needed to allow you to make a decision. Just like when they migrated to the U.S., they didn't know what they were coming to. But they stayed and they sacrificed and they build and they build and they build and they grew. So that opportunity is there. But now I think is, how do we unlock their financing? How do we create opportunities for their investment? And I think that is what is exciting for them too. And we are already on a path of launching a few important projects of national importance for national security that we believe that they can invest in with a very, very good return.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. It has been a wonderful to have you here.
This has been Baker Briefing, where we make news make sense. The podcast is brought to you by Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, which delivers nonpartisan policy research on the most pressing issues facing the U.S., Texas, and the world. Share your feedback and your guest or topic suggestions at bakerbriefing@rice.edu. This episode was produced by Shannon Moriarty. AV production was led by Kevin Young. Special thanks to Ed Bailey, Leslie Marie Aguilar, and Laura Groby. Check out our other podcasts and keep up with our latest research and events at BakerInstitute.org. Thank you for joining us.